We'll provide sarcastic comments and you that, just keep
that'll
talking.
Work. Yeah, that'll work.
Sort of the standard. This is cool. Brian shows up once a season, but we're gonna let him be the lead sled dog today, and that's fine. We should probably say hi to the audience and welcome them to Mention and Dispatches season 8 episode, because at this point we are in fact releasing them out of order. Thank you, invasion of Ukraine. Since we hurried to get that one with me and Brian out, we got a couple of things out of sequence. But at this point, we're a little more than past the halfway mark of the season. And so tonight, Mike is back. The other Mike is back. We got too many Mikes around here. One of y'all's got to be Mickey or something.
Never have enough Mikes, and I will not be Mickey.
So welcome back, Mike. And as mentioned at the start of all this, Brian's back again because we just can't keep him away. And so, Brian, welcome back. And what do you want to talk about?
Hey, thanks for having me back. Well, let's start off with the Ukraine. Let's talk about it a little. Just some of our, own observations about what's going on. First off, let me say, about a year ago, I pointed out how warfare was changing so rapidly, just based on what we had seen during the Azerbaijan-Armenia conflict, seeing drones and all that stuff. And now we're really seeing it coming to fruition. Some of my other observation is, if you're in a tank right now or any armored vehicle and you don't have an active protection system, you're a target,
You were a target anyway. You're just a more vulnerable one now.
Yeah, it was bad before. It's even worse now. Infantry and, portable anti-tank weapons have taken over the battlefield. Even to some extent, I would say, manned portable anti-aircraft missile systems have taken over the battlefield. It's changed a lot. Of course, we haven't seen two powers like this, two modern militaries like this fighting. I don't know what example you want to use since we've seen anything like this. So yeah, I'm just curious, from your standpoint, Brand, I know you're a logistics guy. Some of the things that I'm seeing, I've always said that the Russians stink at logistics. I mean, they could barely, supply 3 divisions in Afghanistan during the 80s. And, to think that they were going to invade successfully in West Germany, I didn't see it. But they're fighting off of singular roads, because here was the thing that really just I couldn't figure out is I expected them to invade, but I didn't think they would invade at this time of year. It made no sense to me. I mean, anybody with any history whatsoever knows how bad, it gets in that area. It's a swampland. And to see them invade during this time of year, it just made no sense.
Well, so a couple of things. One, sort of keeping things generally prioritized towards the wargaming realm, because that's the world in which we live. There's a couple of things to it. So first of all, as we're recording this, the article dropped today about, defining logistics in wargames, the big, 3,000-ish word screed that I unloaded on the wargaming world, that logistics as practiced by professional militaries is virtually undoable in wargaming for several reasons. At the macro level, the majority of the action takes place between the shooting, and at the micro level, it is heavily dependent on individual standards of performance that, when aggregated, simply result in impacts to your combat power. Brian, you and I were both tankers. You spend a lot of time with a wrench in your hand, and it doesn't matter whether you're a lieutenant like I was, or an enlisted tank crewman like you were, you still spend time with a wrench in your hand. And that platoon sergeant is driving that and making sure that it happens and making sure it happens to standard and appropriately, because that's how he learned to do it, and that's how he was taught to do it, and that's how he's teaching the next generation to do it.
Yep.
And that's what you do. And one of the things that I think we're seeing that's very important but virtually impossible to specifically deal with in a game other than simply in the aggregated combat power of the units is the issue of in Western militaries. And most of my experience with the American military, but I've worked with and talked with folks over the years from the German military, from the French military, from the British military, from the Canadian forces, that the adage of you should train as you fight is just an ingrained mantra in the U.S. military.
Yep.
Much like many Western militaries, you want to train as you fight so that your training is as realistic as possible.
They pounded it into you.
They pound it into you. You get beat over the head with this. But the reverse of that is also true. You fight as you train, because while you are training, what you are developing is that muscle memory that when you're too tired to think, when you haven't slept in 96 hours or whatever ridiculous amount of time you're still awake, you've just caught cat naps every now and then, and you're confused, you're tired, you're hungry, you're bored, you're whatever it is, muscle memory kicks in. Hey, first light, stand to, turn on the engine, warm up the turret, we're ready to go if we have to move. All right, now that the vehicle is ready to fight, now I worry about things like shaving and breakfast and whatever else. That when the fueler shows up, you drop whatever you're doing, you put fuel in the tank, because without fuel, you're a pillbox. When the radio guys show up, you make sure you get your radio checked out, because without commo, all you are is local security for your own vehicle. And these are the things that you just do because you've done them so much in training that they're second nature by the time you get to the field and you got to do them for real.
I thought the fueler was just to keep our heater working on the tank.
Well, that doesn't hurt, mind you. It is beyond clear that not only what we're seeing out there from the current Russian vehicular fleet is that regular maintenance wasn't done, which led to a decrepit state of their vehicles, but not using their vehicles at any point in training has shown a remarkable lack of field craft on the part of the soldiers out there in the field trying to do stuff, leaving aside all the political BS about they lied to them about where they were going to war, any of that crap, like just right. Being soldiers in the field, they suck at it.
Yeah. Because
they haven't done it enough to get good at it. And how do you account for that shit in a war game? Right? I mean, this is where your aggregation of combat factors comes in. Who trained, who practiced, who got good at what they were doing so that, you know, when you're in a panicked state, when you're in a non-thinking state, muscle memory takes over, right? We've all been athletes at some point in our life. When you're running down the court shooting hoops and you realize your shoe's untied, you can bend down and tie your shoe without looking at it because it's muscle memory, because you've done it so many times. You can tie your shoe and get right back to running down the court to play defense or whatever. It's muscle memory. It takes over. It's the same thing in the military. So it's me babbling for a minute. Mike, what do you think?
I've just been so distraught by, I know that all the Ukraine stuff has been overshadowed with this news that I still can't get over it, that there's a designated hitter rule in the National League. I mean, what the hell is going on in the world?
I'm 100% with you. I do not like the designated hitter.
I don't get it. You play baseball, you play baseball. That means you hit.
Yes, they are taking all the strategy. Here's a couple reasons I don't like it. That you're taking strategy out of the game, number one, okay? That's obvious. Number two is, you know, living here in Pittsburgh, we're in a small market team that doesn't really try to begin with. This is just going to make it even worse, because now they're actually going to have to carry somebody, you know, pay for somebody in the lineup who can actually hit. And that just takes the, you know, separates the haves from the have-nots even further.
Look, I got pissed off about the DH when Bud Selig kissed his own franchise's ass and sent the Astros to the American League. So I've been pissed about this a lot longer than you guys.
I totally forgot. Got the Astros used to play in the National League.
They made it to the World Series as the National League rep.
Yeah.
They're the only team to make it to the World Series in both leagues.
Yeah. I totally forgot the Astros were a team.
Why were you an Astros fan?
Mike is still gloating from 2019. That's all.
That's right. That's the only thing. That's the only thing I have left to hold on to at this point.
Because in 1980, when I first started caring about baseball, Nolan Ryan was the coolest baseball player out there. And he pitched for the Astros at the time. And so I thought Nolan Ryan was a badass. And so I wanted to be a fan of his team.
Gotcha. Given what's his name? Noogies on his head. Was that Robin Ventura?
Robin Ventura. The rabbit punches to his face. Yeah. The pride of Oklahoma State.
Getting back to what we were talking about, let's talk about Thin Red Line Games and their Under an Iron Sky system, which is based off of what the hell was the SBI game in the past?
The next war.
That's it. There you go. So they have, when we're talking about quality of troops and stuff, they have this thing called a cadre rating. okay, which is basically how good the troops themselves are. When I was first looking at the charts and stuff of this, I was getting a big kick out of it because I totally disagreed with the cadre ratings. I even contacted the man who was developing these games, who I have a lot of respect for, just to question him as to how he got, you know, the cadre ratings. And let's be honest, the cadre ratings for when the game first came out, when did it come out? Like 77, 78 or something like that, compared to the militaries that it was simulating from, say, I believe it's 85 to 88 or something of that nature.
Somewhere around there.
Yeah, the militaries are drastically different. So I thought it would be fun if I had you two try to guess the cadre ratings by country. So let's see what you can do. All right. Yeah. Now, this goes from a scale of 0 to 6. Okay.
Well, so hang on, though. See, when Fabrizio's doing the primary design work on Thin Red Line, mm-hmm. those things take place in 85 for Thin Red Line games, right? Under Iron Sky.
Yes, I believe so. Yes.
Those fights are taking place in 85, which is a drastically different army than in 77.
Yes, that was my point.
Yeah. And so I would expect the cadre ratings for the U.S. military for the next war, you know, it was released in 78, was it, when next war came out?
Around that time period, yes.
Yeah. So you figure, given the design cycle, they're rating those units based on 74, 75 timeframe, mm-hmm. immediately post-Vietnam. The army had fallen apart. It was still it had barely switched from draftees to the all-volunteer force.
Right.
I think you still had a bunch of draftees floating around in the force. You know, the U.S. military cadre ratings are absolutely going to suck.
Yes, yes.
And they should.
Well, we'll talk about the U.S. ones when we get to them. But let's start with Belgium.
Going 0 to 6?
0 to 6. You got Belgium. You go first, Brent.
3?
Mike?
I feel like
I'm guessing. Like, I haven't seen Next War in forever, so.
I feel like this is a trick question. I'll say 4.
Well, wait, let me ask this question. Next War didn't have a Belgian designer or playtester on the staff, did it?
I'm not sure, but.
Well, I'm wanting to ask because the Finns in the Finland, you know, the Winter War expansion for ASL, the Finns are all 10 feet tall and bulletproof. and the Swedes in the original World at War expansion, that not the lock and load redo, but the original, you know, Mark Walker era lock and load Sweden expansion for World at War, I swear the Swedes could pick up Russian tanks with their bare hands and bang them together. So if there was a Belgian designer or developer involved in the next war, then they're an 8.5. But
you're definitely gonna see some biases here, which make no sense, but Belgian was rated a 2.
Okay, I could see that. There's
I can see
how much they got to work with.
I could see that. I might give them a 3, but yeah.
Well, keep in mind too, in the mid 70s, the Belgian military's primary reputation was having fucked up in the Congo in the 60s.
Yes,
and
yes.
Having to have the Americans bail them out.
Well, don't forget, we're going from the newer version, so.
And oh, okay. So you're talking about in Thin Red in the Thin Red Line games versions.
Yes, sir.
Ah. See, I was going all the way back to Next War stuff. Okay.
They're a 2. I would have gave them a 3. Mike, you gave them a 4. Yeah.
I would have gone 4 for the Belgians.
But, you know, somewhere in that ballpark. That's not too ridiculous. Let's go, Denmark next.
The Danes? Yeah, they probably ended up with like a 4 just because that's how they ended up being a focal point of one of the modules.
They can't all be 4.
Mike's just going to guess 4 for everything and figure sooner or later he's going to be right.
That's not a bad idea. I'll guess 3 because you guessed 3 last time.
Well, the answer is 1.
Really?
Yes, a 1. I would have gave them a 2. They're not great. I would have put them on the same level around Belgium, you know, so forth. Yeah.
There's a lot of those NATO minor powers, right? Like if you're doing the big, if you're updating the Third Reich game for 85, then you've got like the Axis minor powers. Then you've got sort of Allied minor powers. These would be like the NATO minor powers. So, I mean, if you're just going to make them all 2s, then all right, fine. Make them all 2s.
Right. Interesting one here. Canada.
I would have expected the Canadas to be like a 4 or something. I mean, I would expect the Canadians to be reasonably decent given that the 4th Canadian Mechanized Brigade Group spent half their life in the field.
You would put them on about the same level as the United States, correct?
Maybe one step below, but not that far.
I would have put them about one step below, just because of equipment,
yeah,
maintenance and so forth, and not always having parts to keep their stuff.
But they were a little better air ground integrated than the Americans were.
So, what's your final number?
I'm going to take my own advice. I'm going to guess 4 for everything, because sooner or later I'm going to hit a 4.
Mike?
5.
Canada, he gave a 6.
Wow.
I have no idea why he thinks 6 is the highest of any country, by the way. There's another country that shares a 6, but
so just for the audience's sake here, these cadre ratings are measuring the quality of the troops from that country across, kind of averaged out across all of their forces. Is that what we're after?
That's kind of it. Yes.
Okay, and this is as modeled in Thin Red Line Games Under an Iron Sky series, or is this the Less Than 60 Miles series?
No, this is the Under a Iron Sky.
Under an Iron Sky. So this is Under an Iron Sky, Deadly Northern Lights, Sacred Oil, and the newly released Mutually Assured Destruction that ties them all together.
Right. Now, one of the good things, obviously, if you have knowledge about this, you can change the ratings if you wanted to make it a more realistic experience. I'm not exactly sure how much these numbers came into play as far as making the game more competitive and playable, if you know what I mean, to make it more balanced, so to speak, between the Warsaw Pact and NATO. So
that's a fair question. You know, again, if this is just the quality of the troops and their training, then I think that's going to be a little different rating than once you start adding the equipment or any organizational issues into it. You know, I could see the Canadians being a little higher in a game that includes a fairly robust air component, simply because the way the Canadian forces were organized, it was almost kind of a giant MAGTAF where they had their own air integrated with them in the command. And unlike the Americans, where they've always got to ask the fighter jocks to remember that they got to land somewhere.
I mean, they burned down the White House. Come on.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, we always had a Air Force. I can't even remember what the hell. It's been so long. We always had an Air Force guy stuck to us and riding around in a modified Bradley to call in.
Yeah, he's the air liaison officer. He's the ALO.
Right.
And he, you know, he works for the S3, which is the ops officer, for those folks that don't know all the NATO staff terminology. He works for the op officer at the battalion level, and they do good work. I mean, for what they're there to do, which is to integrate whatever air traffic control you need for your close air support, they do a good job of it. The challenge isn't with those guys. The challenge is organizationally, the Air Force thinks it's sexy to shoot other people's jets out of the sky, which is cool. Like, we don't want other people's jets shooting at us either, so that's nice. Please continue to do that, but don't forget that us ground pounders down there on planet Earth live where you've got to land eventually, and it would be nice if you would help us maintain control of that ground so that you could come back home sooner or later.
Yep, the age-old argument between the ground forces and the Air Force.
Yeah, well, look, the Air Force has a perfect record. They've never left one up there.
So let's go on. France.
Okay. So I'm going to break my own rule here. I'm betting there are 2, and that's more from knowing the design, knowing, you know, having chatted with the design team a little bit more than anything else.
Incorrect, both of you. 4.
Really? I should have stuck with my 4s. Is that what you're saying?
Should have stuck with your 4. France got a 4, which I think... I don't know about that. I might give them a 3. 4 is reasonable, though.
The problem you run into with the French is you've got like 3 separate forces, though. I mean, that's the biggest thing, is that the conscript force that primarily pulled duty at home inside the borders of France was pretty ragged, whereas the guys that were forward deployed in Germany were pretty sharp. And then the French Foreign Legion has always been their own separate animal. I mean, it's almost like a separate branch of the military.
Right. You have a lot of separate branches there, a total difference in quality. But if you were just talking about a regular armored division, French armored division, I would give them around 3 or 4.
Yeah.
Italy.
All right. I'm sticking with my plan. I'm sticking with a 4, even though I know it's going to be wrong. It's an Italian designer. They're a 7.5.
Mike?
2.
Mike nailed it.
Aha.
A two.
Wow. I'd be curious. I'm wondering if that's just a
two or three. I would say.
Yeah, I'm wondering if that's like an equipment issue. Well, it shouldn't be an equipment issue. It should just be sort of a training and organizational thing. Was Italy still a conscript force at the time?
They were partly conscript, yes.
I'm wondering if the percentage of conscripts is somehow relevant to the values here.
I would once we start getting into the Warsaw Pact countries, you'll see that's probably not the case.
Well, but everybody in the Warsaw Pact was conscripted, so that doesn't really apply there.
Right. LX, Luxembourg.
I got to ask, are there actually units for Luxembourg in the game?
There must be.
Let me rephrase. Are there Luxembourg units, plural? Or is it Luxembourg unit singular?
It can't be many. We know that.
It's a four, right? I'm sticking with a four for everything.
Mike?
Now, realistically, Luxembourg's got to be like a one.
You would think. Mike?
No, I think they got a three.
Luxembourg got a two as well, which might be a little high. Then again, it might be 50 of the best fighters in the world. Who knows?
Minor allied powers, right? They're all twos.
Yeah. Netherlands.
So if we stick with the minor allied power rating, then they're going to be a two. If we stick with Brandt's rating of eventually going to be right just out of dumb luck, then it's a four.
So which one do you think?
I don't know, Mike. What do you think?
I think it's a four.
What do we got?
Two.
All right. Minor allied powers.
Another two. United Kingdom.
Oh, they got to be a four, right? They've got the SAS. How can they not be a four?
Yeah, I would have five.
I would have made them a four. But they are rated a six.
Oh, wow.
Why they would be rated a six, I have no clue.
Well, but is that the British Army across the entire military, entire army, or is that just the British Army of the Rhine?
That, even if it's just the British Army of the Rhine, they're not a six. They're good, but you know, I wouldn't give them a six, the highest level. They're good soldiers. I wouldn't say they're any better than American soldiers with the training, and I wouldn't say they're better than most regular West German, just based on my experience with you know, training and being with the British forces and the West German forces. So I would have said, you know, a five would have been reasonable if you think they're really, you know, all that. But yeah, I thought a six was a little ridiculous myself, but whatever. All right. So how about the United States?
Four.
Mike?
I'm sticking with my rule. There are four.
It's got to be a six.
Nope. United States is a four. Now, this is where now, if you want to go back to the original SPI game, they were rated a three. And
high for 74, 75.
That's exactly what I was thinking. To, you know, say the United States is a four and the United Kingdom and Canada are sixes, I think that's malarkey myself.
But. Well, keep in mind, too, one of the co-designers there is a British guy. So,
well, there you go.
And served in the military at that time.
Now, West Germany is separated into two. You have your white regular Bundeswehr West German army, and then you have the territorial West German, the reserve army.
Yeah, so, it's a four and a two. The territorials are a two, and the Bundeswehr is a four.
That would have been, I would have agreed with that. How about you, Mike?
I'm going to go with that too, because Brandt would know.
They made him a five and a three.
He made him a five and a three.
Yeah.
And trying to tell me that West German's army was better than the United States Army in 1985, I ain't buying it. I trained with these guys. They drank more beer by noon than I did in a freaking 2-week span usually. And they would drink it out in the field.
That's a lot of beer.
Yeah. Let me tell you. They actually used to have racks of beer out front of their, you know, in Grafenwehr, where we would do our training, our gunnery training, outside of where they were staying. They would just have racks upon racks of beer out front. So, yeah, I'm not buying why they would give them a five.
I wonder if it's some sort of home field advantage.
That could be. Now, let's get to some of the Warsaw Pact countries. Now, Poland, Hungary, East Germany and Czechoslovakia all have the same rating.
Two.
It's got to be two or three. Two.
I would have agreed with two, but he gave them all threes. You know, I know a lot of to Hungarian and Polish, giving them a 3 is really pushing it. Because he
well, particularly because they were only going to fight with, you know, a Russian commissar behind them pointing a gun at
him. Oh, they would have, talking to my friends whose fathers were in the Polish military at the time, they weren't going to leave their barracks. They weren't going anywhere. If anything, they would have started attacking the Russian supply lines, probably. But yeah, but that's a very generous 3 across the board for all of them.
I mean, basically what that's saying is that the Polish military was superior to the Belgians and the Dutch and the Danes and
as well as the Hungarians. Yeah, as well as the Hungarian army, and that's just I ain't buying that. The Soviet Union is based on 3 categories: your Cat 1, Cat 2, and Cat 3 troops.
Yeah.
So,
I don't know. I don't know, man.
Well, here, I'll just tell you for the sake of conversation.
Yeah.
Soviet Category 1, 4. Category 2, 3. Category 3, 2.
Yeah, it's
that's
Category 3 units probably should have been 1s, given that they were skeleton formations.
Oh, and to put make category
conscripts. So.
Yes, and to make Category 1 the same as the U.S., don't forget, we're talking about soldiers that would go out and were allotted, even the Category 1s, allotted about to fire 5 rounds every year, okay, yeah, from their tanks. And you're going to give them the same ratings as the Americans? When I was out 4 times a freaking year, you know, shooting gunnery left and right and training, it's BS. Anyway, so that's what they, there's Austria with a 2 and Liechtenstein with a 0. So
the only guy they got, look, the only guy Liechtenstein has is Sir Ulrich of Liechtenstein, right? He's the only guy they've got, and we might have just maxed out our obscure pop culture references for this
episode. I mean, even the Grand Duchy of Finwick got a 1, so come on.
Great with a lance. So, you know, I don't know how many Third World War games you've played, Mike, but I played quite a few of them. And to be honest, the one that seems to get the ratings the best was the Third World War, just re-released by Compass Games. I think they kept the same quality ratings as the original. It was put out by GDW back in the day. But I think they get the cadre ratings right.
Closer to it. This-
yes.
Remind me and remind the audience as well, but the Compass Games Third World War, is that one 85 or is that one closer to like 87, 88?
I believe it's 87, 88 around that time frame.
So that extra 2 years theoretically should have made a difference for the U.S. in that you've got a better integration of the airland battle training, as well as the common task training manuals propagating across the force, which people sort of poo-pooed at the time, but really made a huge difference in the development of U.S. soldier level field craft. Those common task manuals were a big deal.
Well,
emphasizing that individual soldier level training really made a huge difference for the U.S.
Well, it also, a big advantage of it is it doesn't have a rating across the board. Each unit has a rating. So therefore, yeah, obviously your 82nd Airborne and so forth had a rating of 8, I believe, while the regular U.S. Heavy Division had a rating of 7,
yeah,
for example. And the reserves coming from the United States were a 6. The British Army was 8. West German Army was
8. Well, what's the scaling on that one, though?
Division and below on the NATO side.
No, not that. I'm sorry. I wasn't clear in my question. The scale of the quality ratings runs from what to what?
1 to 10.
Okay, so it's a wider scale with a little more range for variation.
Right.
Than what the Thin Red Line games had.
I don't think anybody went down to 1 because basically the way you destroy units is for them to lose their entire that rating. So you take you don't take casualties, so to speak, but it's, say you were attacked, you had a unit that had a rating of 7 and you were attacked and you lost 2, you would lose it from that rating.
Okay.
So yeah, if that makes any sense to you. And so once that rating got to 0, the unit was removed.
Yeah. Now that makes sense. So,
and so I really, I think the Third World War, I think I actually didn't buy the re-release from Compass Games. It's just,
you still got all the other ones.
Yeah. It's just too big. I like what they did, though. I mean, it looks, it's a much better looking thing. I just, it's one of those things that, it, you know, am I ever going to get to this, the table? No. Speaking of, Mike, I saw that you got Pacific War in the mail.
I did.
Did you play the original?
And no, I couldn't find a copy of the original. I guess I didn't try to find a copy of the original. No, I actually watched Art Wolf's unboxing on that today. It was impressive.
Yeah, I had the original back, and it is a bear of a game to play. You rarely are even going to play the campaign game. You're pretty much... It's best, it's at best of doing smaller scenarios, to be honest, you know, the Coral Sea or something like that.
I had the idea that I would play this grand campaign at some point, but there are two maps in there and they're standard size maps. But what you don't realize is there's like 10 to 20 cards in these track things you have to put out also. So I don't think my table is big enough to hold all of that.
Right. You got to have a campaign. You have to have cards for every task force. I mean, you keep.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it's a lot.
So it's almost the kind of thing you would have to bring to a convention and spend the whole weekend playing.
You wouldn't finish it.
And even more it would take up. Yeah, you wouldn't finish it, and it would take up two tables.
Yep.
Dude, you've been to Origins. So we got tables.
I'll start playing the smaller scenarios.
Yeah, you'll start off with playing the smaller scenarios, and you'll see exactly what I mean. It shines at the smaller scenarios, but if you're going to just play the whole Pacific War, break out Empire of the Sun. I think
I also bought the War of the Pacific. And so after looking at Pacific War, I thought, well, let me go back to the War of the Pacific, because surely that's going to fit on the table. No, it's just as big.
Which one? Remind me who that is. Who made
that's
that
Compass
one?
Games.
Yeah, it's Compass. There's the War. The first one was Europe. And this is a new one. It just came out. It's the Pacific. And actually, I think the claim is you can play all these at once. So you probably need four tables to run the whole World War II campaign.
So you were talking about the War Pacific.
Yes, yeah. It's called the War the Pacific, because there's also the War Europe.
Yeah, I have the War Europe. I'd never gotten that to the table, so I came around to saying I'm probably not going to get the Pacific one to the table. So I held off on that one.
Yeah, but I do have Empire of the Sun, and that'll probably be the first Pacific War monster game, if you want to call it that I'll play.
Yeah, it's manageable. It's playable, especially if you're going to be doing it solo. Yeah, I can't say enough good things about it. What Mark Herman did and the way he comes up with concepts, it's truly amazing.
Well, I think plenty of people have noted that between Pacific War and Empire of the Sun, if you have one, you may not need the other. The Pacific War, I think, is one or two echelons lower than Empire of the Sun. But essentially, they're both tackling, you know, largely the same topic. It's just that the Pacific War gives you a little more granularity for those campaign level or engagement level scenarios without having to play, you know, the grand campaign, whereas Empire of the Sun makes the grand campaign actually playable.
Right.
That's the way I've heard it described. Again, I don't have either. I'm just going off of what Gary and several others have said.
Well, the Pacific War, you're controlling individual ships. While in the Empire of the Sun, you're controlling task force. So part of that controlling individual ships and so forth is sending out your scouts and, you know, your air. It's much more, you know, local based than strategic based. It's basically a local game within a strategic game as well.
Yeah, yeah.
So, Brian, you have the original Pacific War, you said. Is the map in that one the same wonky map that's in the new version?
I don't have it out here, so I can't say, but I believe so, and it drives me up a wall, because I just can't stand it. You look at the Pacific from with a south to north, you know, orientation your entire life, and then all of a sudden here's this map where I'm not sure exactly what the orientation is that you're looking at, but it's hard to wrap your brain around it. Let's put it that way.
It is. It definitely is.
Well, you know, somebody had made the joke about it's the map from Waterworld. Remember the map on Tina Margarino's back was upside down and they had to like, flip her over to find their way to dry land?
I didn't remember that till you just reminded me. So
that's, again, we are attempting to max out on obscure pop culture references. And what I'm really waiting for is Tolstoy's show notes on this one to see if he can keep up with all the off-the-wall movies like Waterworld was a gimme because we named the movie. The question is, how many of the other off-the-wall movies are people going to get all the references to here? Right. And we haven't even resorted to Princess Bride quotes yet.
But I'm sure Pacific War wasn't the only game. I'm sure there's other games that aren't coming to mind that where the map was kind of wonky as well, where, you know, a different orientation that just kind of threw you off.
Honestly, there are several different Pacific War maps that all have slightly different orientations like that. The north, south, south, north thing I can kind of get over, but there was one that I remember seeing. And again, somebody's gonna have to look it up because I don't remember exactly. But basically, like, Hawaii is the bottom end of the map and you're sort of working your way up towards Japan, and the, you know, Australia sort of tucked in off to the side somewhere. So obviously this is a Navy and Marine centric campaign map because that was the axis that they fought on, whereas the Army sort of came north out of Australia.
Right.
But it's, I've seen several different orientations for Pacific War maps. There was the one from Hollandspiel not long ago, Empire at Sunrise, I think it is the one that has three different nested maps all in one, where you start with a big, broad, strategic level map and then zoom in two different magnifications.
Oh, yeah.
On different maps.
So, yeah. I got to do a playthrough of that one pretty soon. And some of the American Revolution games will also tilt the map to the side, so you're looking at the colonies from the ocean, you know, so you're looking at the coast versus looking north to south.
And I understand in the Pacific, because of, you know, I'm no expert on map projection, but in order to get the right scale and everything, you know, you look at a regular south to north orientation and Hawaii doesn't look that far from Japan, but if you're actually, you know, projecting it correctly, you know, it's pretty damn far.
yeah Hawaii is pretty damn far from anything.
Well, this is true.
Right. As a dude who's flown there, it's pretty damn far from anything.
As the Dragoons proudly charge into their eighth season of Mentioned in Dispatches, we'd like to pause and thank those Patreon supporters who pledged at the regimental patron level. So a heartfelt thanks to Treb Curry, Staggerwing, Patrick Mullen, Mike Quigley, Hethwill Wargames, Patrick Garrity, Robert, Kevin Bertram, and Joseph Knoll for their support of the Armchair Dragoons and enabling us to bring you the best wargaming content we can. You too can sign up as a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/armchairdragoons.
The last topic I got for you guys tonight is, I was thinking about this, about Kickstarters, okay? Everybody's releasing on Kickstarter now. That's great. I don't have anything against that. But the question is for us, especially in the wargaming world, is it worth it? A lot of these games you're paying more for on the Kickstarter than when they actually hit, you know, the market, the regular market, you know, Miniature Mart or, you know, wherever. So, and let's face it, most war games don't sell out, you know, instantly either. So
I want to ask a clarification here. When you're talking about war games on Kickstarter, are you talking about only Kickstarter specifically, or are you just talking about the broader crowdfunding pledge in advance of the game going to press? Because that would include things like GMT's P500, Multiman's P500, the customer pre-order system at Legion, you know, all of those other ways in which you can pre-fund a game.
No, I don't really have a problem with those as much as I just do, you know, backing something on Kickstarter, for Compass, for example. And I'm basically going to be paying $15, $20 more than, you know, what I could buy it at Miniature Mart or something like that for.
Well, so that's working on the assumption that Miniature Market is able to keep it and keep it in stock in the time span in which you think you're going to get to it.
Well, that's the whole key. I mean, most of these games, war games in general, don't sell out, you know, ridiculously fast. I mean, there are some that do, but by and large, they don't. So you have time to buy them off of these websites. Is there a moral obligation for us as war gamers to help support the company by paying them directly and, you know, them making more off it? I don't know.
I will say that the reasons to actually buy something like that off of Kickstarter is, one, a lot of times they will do Kickstarter only exclusives that will not go with the game when it hits the shelves at miniature market or places. So you might be missing out on some little goodies that otherwise you wouldn't get. And two, another is you're helping to fund some of those goodies, like, you know, I don't know, a cloth map in the case of the role-playing game, Lord of the Rings, or in a war game, it might be you get miniatures instead of counters or something, or maybe some special dice. I don't know. If that stuff's not important, then, you know, then yeah, you're probably better off waiting to
right.
just buy it at miniature market or something.
Right. I agree.
I will say I have not backed a ton of war games on Kickstarter. I've backed a lot of stuff on Kickstarter, but not a ton of war game. And now that you're saying that, I'm pulling up my Kickstarter account because I'm curious as to whether or not my intuition actually holds once the light of the truth is shined upon it.
And I think I'm kind of in that same boat too. I don't think I've bought a lot of war games through Kickstarter.
Yeah, I tend to buy more war games direct from the companies because I want to help the companies out there a little bit more directly. The exception to that is at least once every quarter or so, I'm cruising over to Gamers Armory and I'm buying something off the shelf there just to help keep those guys around because I love them and I want them to be around forever.
Well, almost every Compass game that comes out now is put on Kickstarter a month before it comes out.
Yeah, and I think that's just sort of their last minute. Let's generate some additional pre-orders right before we go live with shipping, but I think part of it is trying to generate some pre-orders from through a different channel, potentially reaching a different audience.
That could be.
I will tell you, that's what I did with Third World War, is that I didn't pledge it on their P500 when it was first put on pre-order. I pledged it on the Kickstarter,
right.
In part because when they were doing the pre-orders was a time of job instability for me, and I just flat didn't have the money, whereas I did by the time they put it on the Kickstarter, and I totally went ahead and did that. I'm looking at my Kickstarter pledges over the years, and depending on whether or not you count Mare Nostrum from Academy as a war game, and I wouldn't. I would put it more as a 4X Civ Builder type.
Right.
I've got three war games on here. I've got the Storming the Gap, World at War 85, massive box that like took a forklift to put it on my porch.
Yep.
I've got that one. I got Zermatt, which just came in from Catastrophe Games, and that was as much trying to help out a new publisher as anything else. And then I got the Third World War from Compass on Kickstarter. The vast majority of the stuff that I've got on here, quite frankly, is a lot of fantasy game type stuff, whether it's tabletop or role-playing things. The majority of what I've got on here is not war game stuff.
Yeah, I can understand that as well, just because, you know, they are going to be harder to get.
Yeah, I've got the Bullseye D6 damage dice, which is part of how Craig Zipsy just got started with his dice business. That was sort of his starting point for all of that. You know, I supported Kaladar, one of the Kaladar products, because I was supporting Bruce Hurd and his new RPG ventures there. I got the immersive battle maps, the giant oversized battle map book that lays flat with the dry erase maps inside, just because it was fucking cool. Oh. I got the T2K role-playing game, because of course I did. The encyclopedia lore book from the French publisher that those dudes, that shit was printed and sitting on the dock right when COVID hit, and it sat there for 18 months because they couldn't afford to get it off the dock. They almost pulped it at one point. I threw a buck at Columbia Games, Kingdoms of Harn, one of the hardcover reprints, again, just to support the campaign, just to try and help some folks out there. I've got the Limitless Heroics Kickstarter that I just recently finished backing. It just recently went live, that, you know, as much to support the cause as the role-playing game as anything else. That's
right.
That's one that they've got a bunch of folks working on it that have a variety of different kinds of disabilities, some mental health related things, some physical limitations, whatever, but they pulled together a whole bunch of these folks and put together an RPG product with them all. And some of the previews were actually really cool. Yeah. You know, I wanted to support the cause there. So I've got a lot of role-playing stuff on here.
But if you want to get even into the P500, like GMT, let me just give you an example here. GMT, the last 100 yards, the latest one that came out, the Solomon Islands one.
Yep.
Selling it for $60 at GMT. Plus, the shipping can get rather expensive at GMT as well. Well, at Miniature Mark, right now, 20 in stock, same game, $45, $15 off, and it's only $5 shipping. So yeah. I don't get it.
Well, but on the other side of the coin, Brant mentioned Storming the Gap. Now, I paid $70 for that, and it came with a forklift full of goodies. $70. It's not selling for $70 right now. Yeah. If you can find it.
No, I bought the same thing. It was too good of offer to, you know, let go by.
Exactly. And I'm not a Cold War guy. And I had very little interest in gaming the Cold War. But I saw that and I was like, how can you not buy this?
Yeah, I was with you.
How can you not buy this?
But like I said, by and large, these companies that are releasing, you know, these pre-games and so forth, it just doesn't seem worth it if you're being budget conscious.
Correct. Yeah. Well, and I think for me, the Kickstarter and pre-order process for me is less about, oh, I really want that game, and more about, oh, I want to support that person or that organization.
That's where the whole moral question comes into play.
Yeah. But I approach it less from a moral standpoint. Look, you're going to have a hard time finding a bigger cheerleader for the wargame industry than me. I want as many of these dudes to sell as many games as possible, to be as successful as possible, to keep wargaming around and as prominent as we can for as long as possible. And there's only one person in the entire wargaming business upon whom I wish ill, and I will never speak of it again. But get me drunk enough at a convention sometime, I might tell you, but even that's only a might tell you. You know, in terms of publishers and creators and people putting games out, whether it's a designer I really like, or, you know, or a new designer with some innovative ideas that I want to help support so that these folks can be around long enough to turn into the next Mark Herman or, you know, Bruce or whatever, you know, to turn into these next, this next round of rock stars. I want to help those guys, you know, get around and stay around.
Right.
But the majority of my pre-order and Kickstarter support stuff, honestly, has been much more focused on who is it that I want to help more than, hey, that's a product I really want to have.
Right.
To your point about things on sale, you know, again, some of these things I'm buying from the local game store, and again, they're products that I want, but where I choose to buy them is in part who I want to support. And so my copy of Iron Curtain, my copy of Brief Border Wars, my copy of NATO, the next war, the Cold War Goes Hot, those I all picked up at Gamers Armory because I want to support my good local game store. I've got a kick-ass local one. I want to keep them around as long as possible. When I picked up King Philip's War and Monty's Gamble, those were both on MMP's fall sale where, you know, I got the two of them plus shipping for less than I spend on a good dinner out. I mean, it's, you know, that was just a really insane deal that I wasn't going to pass up. So I hear what you're saying about,
well, I can understand the whole thing.
You're undercutting on prices, but I think I think the wargamers are going to get the things the wargamers are really interested in getting, whether it's for gameplay reasons or collection reasons or supporting, you know, good designers or whatever.
If the Kickstarter for Divine Right comes out tomorrow, Brant, are you going to back that?
Yeah. Well, okay. So I'm going to caveat that. Who's publishing it?
Ah.
Because there's a couple of companies out there.
Well, let me throw it back on you. Who would you like to publish that?
Well, I mean, I don't think WotC would make a complete hash of it, but I think there's, you know, my fear with Divine Right is that it's going to turn into a giant toy fest if somebody like Fantasy Flight gets a hold of it. So
there'll definitely be some mystery wizards put in there, I guarantee.
Yeah, yeah. No kidding.
They'll sell you a corner of the map, and then the rest will be expansions.
Yeah, maybe. You know, there are some good publishers out there. The Garpill Games does some really great products, but they're intent on developing their own little North Sea universe. They're not going to redo Divine Right. As cool as Red Raven's stuff is and how awesome it looks, there's a particular feel to Red Raven Games that Divine Right just does not fit into that feel that those guys have, that Ryan and those guys have at Red Raven Games. So there's some really quality publishers out there that I think would do justice to a Divine Right remake the way I would prefer to see it done. I'm just not sure. I think the people that would be most likely to republish it are the people that would be most likely to screw it up by trying to put way too many toys in the box instead of just get the game out the door.
Yeah, they make miniatures galore.
Yeah.
You know how much I love those.
Of course you do.
Oh, I hate them. You do. Now,
but, Mike, I'm asking because there are one or two specific role-playing and role-playing adjacent companies out there that I just don't want anything to do with because the people running them are assholes. And it's not really a secret who some of these people are, but I want nothing to do with them. And I suspect that if they ever did get the rights to them and tried to put things on pre-order or Kickstarter, it would ultimately be unmasked as a scam anyway. And I'd just rather not lose my money.
Has anybody ever talked about actually redoing it?
I don't know. I don't even know who has the rights.
Who has the rights to something like that? That's
well, who did the original? TSR?
TSR did. But there are some things that TSR either did originally or did along the way somewhere where the rights have reverted to some different people. There are a bunch of the Dragon Magazine games whose rights have reverted to Tom Lamb over the years. And that's how you went from King of the Tabletop to Kings and Things being released as kind of the remake of King of the Tabletop. So, you know, a lot of those old SPI games that TSR got in the SPI deal that TSR re-released now generally belong to Decision Games, but there are some individual exceptions where some of the designers were able to get the rights back. So I'm not sure who owns the rights to it. I would suspect WotC. That would be my default answer, which means Hasbro, right? So if they re-release it, they'll re-release it under the Avalon Hill imprint and they'll put a bunch of toy swords in it. I would like to see somebody do a good quality divine right like game in whatever fantasy world. And unfortunately, the closest we got was Small World, which was more cartoonish than anything.
Yeah.
It's not a bad game, but the feel is very different. It's a lot more Saturday morning cartoons and a lot less Game of Thrones.
I'm trying to think off the top of my head of a strategic level fantasy game that nothing's popping into my old brain here. Right.
No. Rune Wars from Fantasy Flight is.
I have Rune Wars. It's not really.
Rune Wars is Risk with more options, but it's the closest you're going to get to something like that. Warrior Knights from Fantasy Flight does have a wider range of mechanics to it with the economic and political agendas in it, but the map board is so cramped. We just lost Brian. He hung up on us.
He had enough. That was that last crack you made about.
Yeah, he got mad at me making fun of Rune Wars and he disappeared.
Or we're nearing the end of the podcast time here. He might have rushed off to spend money on buying some of these games because that sometimes happens.
That's been known to happen on occasion.
At the end of a podcast. So yeah, all it right. could be that.
Well, Mike, what are you dialing into order at this point?
Nothing yet. I mean, I was looking at, I just pulled up Divine Right to see if TSR was the only publisher on that. It says one more and it says Right Stuff. And I've never heard of Right Stuff.
Yeah, I have no idea who that is.
I don't either. So.
All right. Is Brian back with us?
Yeah, I disappeared. Yeah,
we bring you into co-host and you disappear.
I ran. But what I was saying, which I'm not sure anybody heard, was I had never heard of Warrior Knights. And looking at the box cover, I do remember seeing it. Never played it, though.
It was originally published, it was originally independently published, and I think it was GDW that picked it up in the mid-80s and did an edition. The Fantasy Flight edition that came out in the mid-aughts, so about 15 years ago, is a pretty good game. The problem you run into, well, there's two problems. Because it's made by Fantasy Flight, you need a pool table to put everything on, just because there's so many different bits and pieces and chits and tokens.
Right.
And but the second part of it is, you really got to have at least four people for at least 4 hours, which can be tough to pull off outside a convention sometimes to really have a good time with it. Three people isn't enough for Warrior Knights because it gets pretty backstabby and it's too easy for two people to gang up on the other one. And once you're down to a two-player game, it's a bit of a slog.
Well, I'm surprised.
If you've got four or five, it's a pretty fun game.
I'm surprised they never kind of incorporated the Game of Thrones, you know, kind of made it into a Game of Thrones style board game.
So they probably could have, but again, Warrior Knights released about 4 or 5 years before the Game of Thrones TV phenomenon took off. Remember, until the TV phenomenon took off, the books were just books, and they, you know, they weren't, they were popular, they sold well, but they weren't any more or less distinguished than plenty of other fantasy series at the time.
Right.
They just got the TV treatment, the big budget, well done, serious prestige TV treatment that so many others could have, would have, should have over the years. So Warrior Knights is certainly adaptable to the Game of Thrones universe and would probably work well for that. The biggest problem Warrior Knights has for being a strategic level high fantasy game is just the map is too damn constricted. It's too tight. If you doubled the size of the map, you would have a much better grand strategy fantasy game there.
So wasn't there a guy in our forums that was kind of doing a game like this, kind of creating a fantasy game like this that was multiplayer with armies and diplomacy? I guess I can look it up. I'm sitting in front of a computer, as you like to say. Let me see if I can find
it. It's Ultra Cheng. It's David. I think his first name is David. His last name is Cheng. And he's got Wizkrieg, and he's got two or three others that he's been
Wizkrieg
developing himself.
That's what
years.
I was thinking.
I love the name.
Wizkrieg. Yeah, Wizkrieg's got some really neat concepts to it. Just looking at it, the little bit that I've looked at it. And for a guy who's bootstrapping the entire thing, he's done a really impressive job of just creating all this himself, kind of out of thin air. I'm not, aside from the cool artwork factor that he has, I would be curious to hear the differentiation and a better compare contrast from Wizkrieg and Wizard Kings from Columbia. They seem very similar. So that's just the impression I get. To really pull off a good grant, if you want Twilight Imperium as a fantasy game, right now the closest you've got is Rune Wars. Unfortunately, that's the best you're going to get. Mare Nostrum is kind of close to that, but it's more history than fantasy.
Right.
Yeah, I'm just not sure where you go.
Well, you can get a copy of Fantasy Flight Games Warrior Knights for $229 at Amazon right now.
Or I can walk over to my shelf and grab my copy. So
that's ridiculous.
I reviewed that one back in 06. I got a copy of it that I reviewed for Scry and Wargamer. I wrote the reviews for both. In fact, I probably have republished the classic review since Scry Magazine went under. I probably republished it with the Dragoons at some point. So somebody can go look and see. I want to know how many people out there are going to back the Kickstarter for the Hanseatic Wheat Orgy once we finish.
While we're talking about Fantasy Flight Games real quick, you've played the Tide of Iron series, right?
I remember the Tide of Iron series in playtesting at Gen Con in 06 when Corey and some of the other guys were there playtesting it. This was back when it was stacks of counters because they hadn't had the minis finalized yet.
Well, just a quick little funny story about that. I had collected all of them except all the different expansions except for Days of the Fox. Which was
on sale at Miniature Market right now, isn't it?
It probably is, but the craziest thing was you couldn't get your hands on this thing. I mean, it was very rare, and I finally got one. Actually, I might have got two because it was so rare. As soon as I got it, I don't know what happened. Fantasy Flight was bought out by, what's her name?
Asmodee.
And all of a sudden, they released thousands of copies of Days of the Fox.
Well, I think what happened, though, was Days of the Fox had the bulk of that inventory had actually been in a warehouse for 1A Games, which was Dana Lombardi and Bill, whose last name is totally escaping me. Him and his dad were running 1A Games, and they had the license to do Tide of Iron. And
right.
Then Fantasy Flight, when the license expired, Fantasy Flight didn't renew it because they were in negotiations to be bought by Asmodee. Now, the exact length of time between all of those things I don't necessarily remember and I'm not going to guess at, but the sequence of events is pretty solid. 1A Games wound up around the time, you know, not long before Fantasy Flight was sold to Asmodee, and I don't know how much the two were directly connected, but 1A Games would have returned all of that inventory to Fantasy Flight at some point that it now belongs to Fantasy Flight to try to unload, because 1A Games had taken possession of all of Fantasy Flight's older inventory of it when
right.
they were the licensee to try to sell it.
Right. So I wound up paying like probably around 60, 70 bucks for this expansion because, like I said, you just couldn't find it. And I mean, it was, it was going for 100 plus a lot of places. Now you can get it for $20.
Yeah, well, because the game's dead. Nobody's well,
that too. Which is a shame.
Was it killed by Memoir 44?
I would call them competitors, though. They are different games, but yeah, I would say it was killed by it.
No, so Memoir 44 was around first. Tide of Iron came several years later. Tide of Iron looks very Memoir 44-ish because it's, you know, cards and hexes and, you know, figures on a map. Honestly, Tide of Iron plays much closer to ASL than it does to Memoir 44.
Yeah.
Tide of Iron is a much more tactically focused game. It gives you better options for customization and specialization of your forces. The command decks really do a lot to add replay value, even to the same scenarios, which is kind of cool. The biggest problem you had, well, you have two big problems with Tide of Iron. First of all, the game box is the size of an aircraft carrier. It is a son of a, I mean, it's a piece of furniture. It is a son of a bitch to store. The second thing is that the first time you play Tide of Iron is actually the second time you play Tide of Iron, because the first time, the actual first time you get the box open, you're going to spend 2 hours assembling minis onto stands because of the way you can customize all the squads. And right, once you've got them all built the first time with all of the figures, because there's four pinholes in each base, and so you can put four figures in each base. Some of the figures are two-man figures for like the heavy weapons, for like the mortars and machine guns. But you've got to sit there and put all of these figures in all of these bases the first time you get the box out. Now, once everything's in the bases, after that, you're just making adjustments to pre-assembled bases. So you want to take a rifleman out of this and replace him with an elite dude just to plus up that squad slightly. Like, that's fine. You're only moving two figures around. The first time you open it up takes you 2.5 hours just to assemble the damn game. So
it's much more complex than Memoir 44.
Oh yeah. Yeah. A lot more tactically detailed and tactically interesting.
Yes.
Yeah. I had done a review of Tide of Iron, and it's one of our classic reviews on the site. I'd done a review of Tide of Iron for Scry Magazine, and I'd done an interview with John, who was the lead designer, back in the old Wargamer days. So this was 2005, 2006, 2007, somewhere in that time frame. I think it was 2007 was when I did those things. And I actually got offered a chance. There's a scenario book that they released in 2008, 2009-ish. And the scenario book had a bunch of pretty well-known designers, like Dana Lombardi and others that had designed scenarios for him. And they asked me if I wanted to design a scenario for him. And I turned them down because I thought that if I did, Zabek wouldn't let me continue to review Fantasy Flight stuff for Wargamer.com, and Scry wouldn't let me continue to review stuff for them. And at the time, I was actually making money writing reviews. So like, I didn't want to, you know, cut off that gig. When you're in grad school, you need all the money you can get.
Yep.
Found out later. So Scry goes under like a year and a half later, and Zabek said, well, as long as you're not reviewing a game you designed, I don't care. And so I'm like, well, damn it. Why didn't anybody tell me this 6 months ago? I could have had a published design. You know, I could have been published in a book with all these other famous designers. So I'd actually designed basically the fight at the end of Kelly's Heroes. That was the scenario I'd put together. So it wasn't a very well-balanced scenario. The intent was more just to have a good time. So, yeah. But it was it's a better game than its reputation. You know, unfortunately, it doesn't have a great reputation. It's a good game, though. It's just, again, like everything else from Fantasy Flight, you need a pool table to play it on. So, which, in the case of Tide of Iron, you need a pool table to store it on.
My latest purchase, and I'm putting on the table tomorrow, is Tarawa 43 by Worthington, a solo game.
Yep.
Very, very small game. Look, it has me intrigued. Everybody seems to be raving about it, so...
Mike, why do you not have that one yet?
Because, and see, this is one of those games where I would love to try it before I buy it, because I look at that game and there's just nothing there. There is nothing there. It's this tiny map, some blocks, and that's it. It's like, where's the game? And well, like Brian says, everyone is raving about it. So there's definitely, I'm curious, but I'm not going to go out and spend that much money for a little tiny game. There's nothing there.
Well, this is the problem with a lot of solitaire games in itself, is how much are you actually doing? You know, numerous solitaire games, it seems like you're just along for the ride. you know, any, what are the,
dice chucker for the AI.
Yeah. The hunters, the hunted, the submarine games by GMT, target those, for today.
Are those GMT or those Compass?
No, that's GMT.
That is GMT.
Yeah. There was a strategic Pacific War, silent service by Compass or that's silent war.
Thank you.
Yeah.
No, you've got to be making some kind of decisions in a solo-only game like that. You can't just be chucking dice just to chuck dice. That doesn't work.
Agree.
I've heard that complaint about the States of Siege games that you don't have enough agency as a player. I have not found that to be true in the two or three States of Siege games that I have played.
I agree with you. The States of Siege games I've played, I am making decisions. Or they've convinced me that I am, but I feel like I'm making decisions.
I was watching your Cruel Necessity playthrough, and I still haven't played. I have it. I haven't played it yet, but that's definitely intrigued me to get it out there.
That's a good example, because I feel like in that game, you have decisions to make. You know, you have very few of those points to spend, and you've got to really think about what you're doing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that one, I look at it, and I'm just like, of course, I say that, and I did back Worthington's 1944 D-Day to the Rhine. That was a Kickstarter. But there's something there, though. If you look at that map and the components, there's actually more of a map there.
You know what cracks me up about that is that you passed on the Pacific Theater one to support the European Theater one.
Crazy.
Again, look at the components.
Well, it is. I'll tell you what, the Terrawa 43, all the components. Once again, I had the sticker blocks. I hate that. But anyway, it's a small package compared to some of the games you see nowadays.
Yeah. Well, maybe, you know, what you should do is send your box to Aardwolf and maybe he'll do a special stickering clipping show.
Or you could do your own stickering show. And
yeah, because if you send it to him, he's going to be drinking scotch and you're not going to like what you get back. So that's a bad idea. Never mind.
Yeah, so Aardwolf is a unique character in that, you know, he'll sit down, counter clipping. He does all the things that I hate about wargaming, but I can see, I understand the zen that you can get from stuff like that, I suppose.
Yeah, well, it's funny because when Gary started the counter clipping show, he's bored one day. He's like, oh, I'm clipping counters. I'll just turn the camera on and just talk and see. And like 10 people showed up and, you know, they chatted a little bit in the chat on YouTube and everything. He's like, that was fun. Let's do this again next week. And like 20 people showed up the next week. And like 6 weeks later, he had 100 people watching. And he's like, well, I guess I'm doing a Monday night show from now on.
Yeah. What's funny is when he started doing that, I was like, he's doing what? Who's going to watch him sit there and clip counters and talk? Nobody's going to watch that. Well, I've been watching since then.
Yeah. Well, and it's become, to Gary's credit, it has become one of the primary social events of the wargaming calendar right now. And if it hadn't happened, it all started during the pandemic. And if it hadn't happened during the pandemic, when we were all sort of starved for some socialization, it might not have ever actually taken off the way it did. But
that's true.
It's worked out fabulously. I'm thrilled for the dude because Gary's one of the greatest guys in wargaming. He's an awesome dude. And I'm happy he's found some great success with this. I think it's done wonders for helping bring the wargaming community together better as a community, despite being as geographically separated as we all are, right? I mean, we're the three of us are all 500 miles apart, and here we are having a podcast together. So it's worked really well to that end. And as much of it is the conversation between the people in the YouTube chat that aren't even necessarily talking to Gary, they're talking to each other.
Right.
And,
yeah.
And that's been pretty cool. And
And there are people showing up clipping their own counters at the same time. So it's kind of like you're all sitting around this digital fire clipping counters and talking. It's awesome.
Yeah. And like Kranz started trying to get Con Sim World chat nights together back in like 2008. Cause I can remember dropping into a few of them when I was down here before the family had moved down here. When I'd first moved down here by myself for the job before the family had moved down here later that next summer, Kranz used to have these Wednesday night chat sessions for Con Sim World with this chat thing that he bolted onto the old forums. Well, the forums are still there. This old chat thing he had bolted onto there that, you'd be lucky if you got a half a dozen people show up on most Wednesdays. And they've still got a Wednesday night chat with their Discord server. I don't know how many people show up, but like Gary's show draws a crowd and he's talking back to the crowd a lot. Moe's Whiskey Charlie show that's once a month that was on the same night as we're recording this. Mo draws a decent crowd, but it's not, it's more the couple of that, because it's a multi-person show. It's more them talking to each other than it is talking to the crowd. I mean, they interact with the crowd some, but not as much as Gary does, because Gary has to. He's a one-man show. I just think it's really cool that Gary's pulled this off.
Well, I'll tell you what, we are blessed with a plethora of good YouTube wargaming channels right now. I mean, even yours, Mike, is great. Yeah, there's tons of them out there. And
I can't even try and watch them all.
It's almost overwhelming. And thank God they have huge bank accounts, too. I'm not exactly sure how some of them afford the games that they're getting, or they got something going on with the publishers. I don't know. I don't care. But
one of the secrets to getting through videos on YouTube, quite frankly, is start watching them at 1.25 speed. And once you've got to the point where you can absorb what they're saying, you can bump it up to 1.5 speed. As long as you're not having to watch a ton of mechanics on the map, which, Mike, I can't watch yours on fast forward, but I can watch other people's on fast forward.
Yeah. No,
the mechanics. But like Gary's show on Monday night, I'll catch usually about a third of his show live. And then the rest of it I watch the next morning while I'm working on Tuesday Newsday, you know, and finishing that up. I'll put Gary on and I'll put him on about 1.5 speed, because I've got to the point where I can listen to Gary that fast and still absorb what's being said.
His is good too, because if you're driving, or, you know, like once every spring when I ride the exercise bike, you can just put that on and listen to it. It's not a lot of visual there, you know?
No, yeah, like no, there's times where it helps to see the chat replay going alongside so that you know what he's reacting to, but even that's not excessive.
Yeah.
So yeah, you definitely. But like Patrick's tactics and tutorials, you can't watch too fast because he's showing you how the game is played. So that's, you kind of got to watch that at speed. But Whiskey Charlie, like, you can watch Mo's show on high speed. The Everything You Want to Know About Wargaming with Gary and Dan, you can watch that one on high speed. Dan just sounds like a chipmunk when he starts laughing. But other than that, it's, you know, it's fine. You can absorb them.
Okay. So I wonder who's listening to us right now at high speed.
Probably me.
Now, you can't edit at high speed. That's time.
Oh, God, no.
Know how that goes.
The challenge of editing these things, as anybody that's done edits knows, it's however long this recording ends up, add 50%. That's how long it takes to edit.
At least.
Just as a baseline.
So I had an oh shit moment today, because I was actually editing about a 1 hour video I did. And I was about 20 minutes in, and all of a sudden the audio just dropped. And I looked down at the screen and there was no audio after 20 minutes. And I was like, oh my God, the mic cut out. And, you know, at that point, what do? You can't do anything, because, you know, you have to re-record the whole thing. But I got lucky and something happened in the editor where it just, I don't know why, it chopped off that last 40 minutes or so, and I was able to reload it, get it back. But there are times when you record something that, you know, if you mess up bad enough, you've got to start over. So there's a lot of time involved.
So it scared the crap out of you, didn't it?
Even for the unboxings. That's a lot of work, taking all those pictures. Oh.
So, all right, guys, we're over an hour here, which means at least 90 minutes of edit time for me. So I think we can call this a successful podcast, particularly since, you know, we pulled it together in like 36 hours. But I do appreciate y'all being here. Brian, thank you for showing up and like being prepared with some actual points of conversation, so that we weren't completely winging it. We were only partially winging it.
Not a problem.
Good stuff.
And Mike, you realize one of these days you need to show up like being prepared to lead this whole thing, right? So that I don't have to.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. It's on my ever-growing list of things to do.
Hey, quick question. Why aren't either of you in the Blood Bowl tournament?
Because I suck at Blood Bowl.
Well, that doesn't stop most of the people.
I'm going to let somebody else finish last. Honestly, I don't even think I've got it on the on my system. So.
Oh, really?
And I'm too busy editing videos. So.
Yeah. No, I'm running the March Madness tournament and editing podcasts. So.
I didn't even know we had a March Madness tournament.
Yes, it's in the Olympias part of our. So, unfortunately, by the time anybody is listening to this, March Madness has already started, and it's going to be too late to join the brackets. But this is, I mean, the first one of these I did was in like, what, 06, 07? I mean, it was back at Wargamer when we started this, and we've kept it through multiple sites over many different years. And so every year they've had a tournament, we've had the bracket challenge. Last year, there wasn't but three of us in it, right? It was me and Metal Dog and OJ's dad is all we had in the brackets last year. This year, I think we got a few more. So, Brian, there's still time for you to jump in there and join
us. I would be about as useful as my wife at this point. I have not been following college basketball.
I haven't either, largely because my team sucks. And it's just,
well, there you go. You know the feeling.
Yes, but look, dude, have your wife join the bracket challenge for you then. That's fine. It's totally okay.
She'll pick my wife. Go ahead.
I was going to say, have her do it like Diane did on the episode of Cheers where she picked football teams based on which mascot would destroy the other mascot. You know,
like
a bear could kill an eagle.
I was going to say the exact same thing.
See, great minds think alike. Great old minds think alike, right?
There we go.
I was about to say, when we get some great minds on this podcast, we will test that theory. Until then, we're stuck with us.
That's true. So,
what are you going to do?
All right. Audience, thank you for sticking with us in this sort of all over the map roller coaster of a podcast, but we do appreciate it. And so thanks again to Brian and Mike both for joining us here on this episode of Mentioned in Dispatches. We'll catch you next time around, probably about a week from now when our next podcast drops. In the meantime, tell all your friends to come give us a listen. Pop over to iTunes and give us a rating. If you haven't already, please do, because we've got to hit a certain threshold of ratings before we'll start showing up in the recommendations. So it'd be kind of cool to get a few more recommendations just so that we can start showing up in people's suggestion engines. So when you get a chance, please do that. Thanks a bunch. And we'll talk to everybody next time on another episode of Mentioned in Dispatches.